the most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So lots going on. Again, you know, the craziness. Yesterday, third anniversary of the horrible tragedy in France, and yet, you know, Trump does the, hey, if it weren't for us, you'd be speaking German. Yeah, the French not happy. They're not thrilled at all. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on what's going on around the world and in Washington, D.C., Luke Vargas, Chief Foreign Correspondent for Talk Media News. Luke, thanks for taking time for us.
I'm always glad to be with you.
So, yesterday, like I said, you know, the third anniversary of this horrible tragedy, and Trump recognizes it by pointing the finger at the French, and going, "Weren't for us, he'd be speaking German."
It's just never ceases to amaze me that he can find so much hatred, just like a wellspring of hatred against America's close allies, and can just never muster that energy of condemnation when it comes to our adversaries. I think Macron is a brilliant case in point of that.
Yeah. Let's find out what's going on around the world. Evidently, trouble in Britain. Theresa May under fire.
Yeah, as we're taping this, middle of the day on Wednesday, Theresa May has just emerged to announce that her cabinet, the ruling Conservative Party cabinet, has backed the Brexit plan agreed to by her government and the European Union, which will now bring this to a vote in the House of Commons to decide whether to move forward with Brexit. But let me just say why that is not a settled matter, and to give you a very brief recap. I'm not going to talk about the substance of this Brexit divorce bill, as it's called, because it is quite particular to issues in Northern Ireland regarding customs unions and border crossings. And it gets a little bit muddy. But what we should basically keep in mind is that some major dynamics have shifted since the Brexit referendum 2 years ago. The first is that the sort of loudest pro-Brexit voices out there are much quieter now than they were on the outset. Many of them have been humbled, which is perhaps the wrong term, but they've been quieted after their campaign claims during the whole Brexit process were found to have been fraudulent in some cases or just outright lies. I know one of the popular ones was that the European Union would save tens of billions of dollars every year, that it was otherwise just like burning and giving to the European Union. Those numbers that were the subject of that Brexit campaign slogan were basically found months after the vote to have been completely cooked up. And so that was quite embarrassing. Other claims that they made, such that 40-odd trade deals would be ready for the UK as the clock struck midnight and they left the European Union, have utterly failed to materialize. The UK has zero trade deals lined up to replace all of the ones that will expire when they leave the European Union. And so take that as a whole. I mean, that is sort of a self-inflicted political defeat for many of the loudest cheerleaders for Brexit. And the people who replaced them are a lot more cautious. So this is the second group. These are people who, I guess you could say, are pro-Brexit insofar as they like this notion of more independence from the European Union. They represent poorer communities around the UK, places where people feel like the influx of immigrants through the sort of freedom of movement of the European Union brought in a bunch of cheap labor, has sort of eroded British values, and they probably associate a lot of, you know, the political culture in London with the sort of cosmopolitan snobbery of the European Union. And that's something I think we can see in a grain of in American politics as well. So these sort of gentle Brexiteers are not blind sheep. In fact, they want to know that Britain is going to get something tangible out of the Brexit deal. And they've gotten the fact that after Brexit, there will be no freedom of movement around the European Union. But this is where the European Union has proved, I think, to be incredibly adept. Basically, it has refused to discuss with Britain any of the possible positive things that might come of Brexit until the divorce bill is finalized. And I know this divorce bill sort of marriage metaphor is not a perfect fit, but you could, if it is one popular in Britain, then you could say you're not going to even be able to talk about who gets custody or who gets what assets until you've agreed to the divorce. And of course, that's a very troublesome thing for many people to think about, because it could well be you don't get anything out of the deal and you've already agreed to it. So in that respect, the European Union negotiating strategy has wrecked the Brexit consensus. And finally, you have the Remain camp. These are sort of members of the Labour Party and even some within the Conservative Party who felt like this was a bad idea the whole time. And their strategy has been a little bit mixed. They've been largely staying on the sidelines, accused often of just trying to muck up the process, delay things, you know, point out embarrassing things for Theresa May, which I'd largely say is sort of what they've done. And they're understandably hesitant to fully embrace a re-vote, right? They don't want to be seen as just erasing the will of the people. They want to try and bring this whole Brexit thing, cause it to implode from the inside out. And so that is the constituency, basically, that Theresa May needs to corral to try and get this through. And the fight, you know, there's been a thinking within her government that, you know, British pragmatism is going to win out at the 11th hour, that faced with the prospect of no deal, you know, like crippling financial hits of big mass confusion over Britain's future, that everyone will fall into line. That's an option, and that's what she's counting on now. The other one is that this very disparate coalition just completely fails to see why their fortunes need to be intertwined with Theresa May and with this bad Brexit process, and she doesn't have the votes, and this whole thing implodes. So as much as the cabinet in the last few minutes has said they're on board with Brexit, I don't think the vote outcome is anywhere clear, nor, for that matter, is Theresa May's political future. Because if she falters here and this bill doesn't get through, we may see an end of Brexit. We may see calls for her to resign. We may see calls for a second referendum. It's truly a wild west if that's the scenario. So a little bit long-winded there, but it's a kind of a fascinating political car crash to watch in slow motion.
No, I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, I've been you know, kind of paying attention to a little bit, but you know watching, you know, as a really kind of a disinterested spectator, you know, on how this is going to play out, because you're right, it's fascinating watching all these chess pieces move around the board.
Yeah, the hilarious part is looking at these, like, people like Nigel Farage and his ilk, you know, sort of people who thought that this, like, super symbolic expression of British sovereignty and nationalism, the sort of FU to the EU that Brexit was going to turn them into, like, nationalist folk heroes, right? That these people who had never been taken seriously by the political elite were suddenly going to be, like, the most respected members of the British political system. And, like, the exact opposite has happened. Like, as I described to you before, a lot of their campaign tactics were sort of revealed as fraudulent. And then as the going got tough, they completely showed no willingness to actually get in the trenches and lead this process and negotiate with a very competent European Union here. And instead, they've just retreated and left much more sort of cautious, moderately pro-Brexit people to steer the talks. And so it shouldn't be surprising that the whole enthusiasm, you know, sort of the air has come out of the balloon here. It's fascinating. And I think the EU's biggest victory here is that at a time when many people are writing the European Union, or had been writing the European Union, sort of political obituary, when you look around and see threats to European integrity from Greece to Spain to Italy to Hungary, that by making Brexit so unpleasant for the British government and so frustratingly unpopular and like a tumultuous long slog for the British people, they feel like they've successfully dissuaded anybody else from attempting to go down that road as well. And so they are perhaps preserving European unity by showing if you hate the European Union bureaucracy now, just await the bureaucracy that will come for you if you try to leave. Basically their approach. And it seems to have kind of worked. And I think they've proved remarkably adept.
The fear of the unknown. Let's move on. Back here at home. Thank goodness Donald Trump has sent, 5,200 troops to the border down south?
Hanging out at the Whataburger. I've seen a higher number.
They're going to be 80 of the insurgents are coming through Mexico. And I guess today they're supposed to, the insurgents are coming, the invaders, the 80 invaders will be here.
Yeah, a few dozen persecuted lesbian, gay, and bisexual and transgender youth from Central America will be, you know, just pummeling our soldiers trying to illegally cross into the... No, of course. I mean, we are hearing about several dozen, perhaps as many as 100 or 200 people who sort of broke away from the main pack, if you want to... I feel I already regret that term. Broke away from the main group of people who are walking and took buses to Mexico City and have now taken volunteer some transportation was volunteered for them and are now at Tijuana and are going to be presenting for asylum there, which is what most people thought the majority of this caravan will do. Why would you come thousands of miles by foot, separating your family and your children from school, from their livelihoods and from everyone they know to hit the road? And then with all eyes of the American government on the southern border, why would you then try to cross illegally, clearly only to be caught, hit with a criminal conviction, and then, according to the new asylum rules, denied any chance to possibly press your claim to be admitted legally into the United States? Of course, that is not going to be people's reaction. People are going to wait in an orderly system to try to apply for asylum. Unfortunately, them doing the right thing here and going through those official channels probably won't get them very much because, as we've talked about on this show before, the Trump administration has not invested any meaningful resources in speeding up the application process to apply for asylum, which means these people will probably have to wait for weeks. They will be at the mercy of people who want to hurt them, rob them, manipulate them, take advantage of them as they camp out probably in the streets of Tijuana and other border towns waiting to get a hearing from U.S. Border officials. We've been told that even before this sort of influx of people coming to parts of the American sort of Southwest, the border with Tijuana and places like that, that wait times just to press an asylum claim in person have been, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. And that's before the influx comes. And so, you know, it just completely what we're about to see here completely undermines the stated rationale of many Trump administration immigration policies, which is we don't want, you know, we're cracking down on illegal immigration because we don't want people to be exploited by human smugglers. And this is what we say to justify policy in Turkey and Northern Africa and now in Central America. But so we're concerned about these people being, you know, preyed upon. And yet we're totally okay with border policies, which force people to just clog up at our ports of entry and have to basically be homeless for weeks, completely at the mercy of exploitation, just to press a claim that they are entitled to under international law. So, again, we're not going to see a siege of the border, but you probably are going to see some pretty grim scenes at these border crossing checkpoints because there are plenty of soldiers there, but far too few people to actually evaluate the claims of these migrants. So it's going to be a real problem.
Yeah. What does it say about us? I mean, it's just insane. Let's move on. Evidently, President Trump doesn't want to go to Asia either. Sent Pence instead, I guess.
Yeah. My transition was going to be that, you know, during the election, it was announced by the White House that Trump would be going this week to visit those brave service members who are there to defend us from the migrants. And then at the last minute, he decided not to go and is sending Mattis instead. I mean, I think it's a pretty clear pattern here that Trump loves to surround himself by the U.S. military when it's for his own political benefit. But then when it comes to going to combat zones, to seeing soldiers, to putting at least some degree of effort into going to veterans events, even taking the 2-mile drive from the White House to Arlington Cemetery on Veterans Day in D.C., didn't want to do that either. And now isn't there to defend why these service members, many of whom have just come off of deployments in other military theaters around the world and were expecting to have holiday with their families, are now being taken away from that and deployed for a seemingly senseless mission at the border. So Trump doesn't want to do that, nor does he want to go to the 2 largest diplomatic gatherings that are being held in Asia. These are always on the calendar, APEC and ASEAN. They are basically elements of the political calendar that became mainstays during President Obama's quote-unquote pivot to Asia, when we recognize that, hey, you know, a pivot to Asia doesn't mean we are pivoting away from the U.S. It means that's where the U.S. thinks opportunity and challenge are going to be presenting in the next few decades. So we've got to enmesh ourselves in those communities. And you saw Obama, I went to one of these summits in Vietnam, going to these and every year, these 2 summits, basically. And now for the second year in a row, Trump has decided not to go. This was also something the White House had indicated he was going to do for much of the year, only to send Pence at the last minute. So, I mean, it sends a pretty clear signal, I think, that the U.S. Is ceding that territory to others. You know, the two heads of state who will be at all those meetings are Russian President Vladimir Putin and Chinese President Xi Jinping, who feel like, great, you know, these are countries in our neighborhood that the U.S. had been successfully pulling into the American orbit in recent years. Well, if President Trump's going to back off and cede some ground here, they're more than happy to try and pick up the pieces. So I'm very upset at the sort of abdication of a true American presence at these events. And it's concerning to me because they're getting zero coverage, and thus people don't know how important this is. These are meetings that you would expect American presidents to be at, drumming up attention for the vital role of the Asia Pacific in American foreign policy. And instead, not only are we not there, but we're just sort of almost signaling in the process that the Asia Pacific issues don't even deserve to be in the headlines, when in fact they really are our core interests. In
America. Yeah. Again, you know, the irreparable harm this administration is done and is doing, just, you know, almost incomprehensible how much damage they've done so far. And finally, you know, as you point out, you know, Russia and China both going to be there. Evidently, a new report out from Reuters that a Chinese tech firm has helped the Venezuela government build what is, I guess, how you've put it, a chilling surveillance state.
Yeah, it's a little bit of an editorializing description from me. So, but let me make the case. I mean, so Venezuela has a new national ID card called the Carne de la Patria, the Fatherland card, which is basically a new requirement issued by the state to possess one of these identity cards in order to receive food subsidies, which basically everyone receives, in order to get medical care, in order to get a range of welfare services that people depend on. And bear in mind, Venezuela has nationalized a ton of different things that here are private. So going up to fill your car up at the gas station, you're buying it from the Venezuelan government, you know, through Citgo and other things like that. And so you can't do any of these transactions now unless you have this national ID card. What Venezuela did is contracted this out to ZTE, which you might remember is Chinese telephone company, which have been found to be a violator, a mass egregious violator of U.S. sanctions on North Korea and Iran, and maybe are now violating Venezuelan sanctions. Remember, Commerce slapped a big fine on ZTE earlier this year, and then Trump, while trying to get, you know, curry favor with the Chinese, said, look, too many jobs will be lost in China if we punish this company, which seemed ridiculous given the fact that they were basically the poster child of violating U.S. sanctions. And he pushes Congress to eliminate the ban on ZTE operating in the United States. He could have probably put this Chinese phone company out of business and instead has let them back into the market. And what they did is help the Venezuelan government engineer this ID card so that it links all of your receipt of benefits to a very robust online sort of profile of you that includes, oh, you know, all of your financial history, your medical records, your voting behavior, your social media presence, and much like you see in China, where you have sort of the building of what they call a social social credit number, which is a favorability of you as a citizen in the eyes of the government score. The government in Venezuela is having all these sorts of promotions. Like if you go and vote for the ruling party and then present your card to a booth of the party supporters, they'll charge up your card with some cash, or you get they're just basically doing payouts to moms on Mother's Day, or if you participate in a rally for the president, you can scan your card and get some benefits as well. And they're basically culturing the Venezuelan people to obey the government, or else you lose access to all of these services. Yep. And the stories of people in this Reuters report who, you know, older people who are hesitant about this, either because they're wary of the technology or because they think this is a grave violation of their, you know, sort of personal identity and privacy, are finding that they can't get medical care, that the mere fact of not having a national ID card marks you as a political enemy in the eyes of the state and its supporters. That, to me, is about as Orwellian as it gets. And thanks to us and the White House pressure trying to let ZTE off without much punishment on this. They're a well-heeled company, which looks poised to keep exporting this kind of authoritarianism around the world. It's a very distressing story, and I wish we could say Venezuela is the only place it's going to happen. But I have a hunch, with China and Russia setting the global, you know, sort of pace right now, that this kind of technology, which was so easily and willingly sent by China to Venezuela, will probably be sent to many other countries around the world.
No, and I've often said, look, I didn't realize they have this kind of technology yet. I said, it's coming. And eventually at birth, they'll just chip you and all of it'll be, right in your arm or wherever they put the chip in or the barcode or whatever. It's coming.
What was really very worrisome to hear in this report was the way that, a lot of people know the extent to which this thing tracks your behavior, but they use these sort of emotionally manipulative tactics to get people to sign on. So the reporter found out that the card doesn't know who you voted for. It merely knows if you voted, because I guess you scan it when you go into the polling place. But they told people, people who were out in the streets promoting this, trying to get people to sign up, were evidently told to tell enrollees that it did know who you were voting for, that it could see whether you were voting for the ruling party or for the opposition, which to me is just so insidious, right? It's sort of planting this this notion of an ever-present sort of monitor hanging over your head so that, who knows how many people will never know the truth about that and will continue to vote out of fear for the government for years, their entire lives, just because they were led to believe that it's really an omniscient surveillance state that's watching you the whole time. That to me was just the epitome of emotional manipulation of the people by the state. That's really, really upsetting to think about.
Yeah, I mean, really, really scary times. Luke, I appreciate the thoughts, the time. Good stuff. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Always good to talk to our friend Luke Vargas. Make sure you check him out at The Courier on Twitter. And also the folks there at the Talk Media News. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. I'm the Talk.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.